No doubt the unemployment figures are grim, but among African-American young men, they are downright catastrophic. 52% of black men between the ages of 16 and 19 are unemployed, and that only counts those still looking for work. Economists say legions of other young black men, no one knows how many, have given up the search. NPR's Sam Sanders reports.
Andre Johnson is 18 and a student at the Youth Build Charter School in the District of Columbia. He talks about his fruitless job search.
I apply for jobs every day, and usually I do it online because I know before when I used to go into stores, they used to look at me actually different and weird, and they say, oh, we don't have no applications or nothing, and I never believed them.
Academics believe only 14 in 100 young black men actually have jobs, and Washington, D.C. has the worst teen employment rate in the country. Experts point to several reasons for the disparity. Allison Lee is a job placement specialist at Youth Build. The school helps youth complete their GEDs, gain job training, and land internships and jobs. Lee says she sees discrimination from hiring managers firsthand.
They have told me on the phone or to my face that they're hiring, and when I send a student in by himself who's a young black male, they're told, no, we're not hiring.
Academics say there are other reasons for these high unemployment rates. There are few African Americans working in hiring offices, and few networks exist in their communities to help them get jobs. It all sets up a disturbing trend. The Economic Policy Institute says the numbers are so bad, the job prospects of white adult felons are still higher than those of black teenage men without any criminal record. Also, older workers who have been laid off from higher-paying jobs are now taking the entry-level jobs many black teens apply for. In fact, more people over 55 are working in this recession than were before. And it's not just low-income households that are hurting. Dr. Andrew Sum is with the Center for Labor Market Studies. He found that upper-middle-class black teenagers are less likely to be employed than low-income white teenagers. Sum says that young people need to work during their teen years.
Those people who work a lot when they're teenagers not only benefit when they're teenagers, but they also will work more and earn more when they're 20 to 25 years old. The more you work now, the more you work tomorrow.
18-year-old Anthony Bishop stands in front of his school in Southeast D.C. It's the Building for the Future Charter School. He's on his lunch break, outside in the cold. He's been applying for jobs and has tough love for job seekers.
Young black men need to stop dressing certain ways when they go and apply for a job, because some black people just go on the job, you know, baggy jeans, you know, just try to apply for a job, but that ain't the right way to go. You got to go dress for the occasion.
A few miles away, back at Youth Build, 19-year-old Isaiah Brown has a few words for all the managers who wouldn't hire him.
I would just tell him you missed out on a good hard worker who comes every day, who do what he's told, and you just missed out on a good opportunity for your business.
Corey Evans, another Youth Build student, is still optimistic.
This black brothers out there just keep trying and don't let nothing hold you back.
Evans says the best way to get a job is not to worry about the economy or your color, even if others do. Sam Sanders, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Tough news today for the millions of people struggling to find work. The latest jobs numbers are worse than expected. In December, the economy shed another 85,000 jobs. President Obama called that a matter of concern to every American.
The jobs numbers that were released by the Labor Department this morning are a reminder that the road to recovery is never straight.
NPR's Frank Langfitt explains what the numbers tell us about where we are on that road to recovery.
The U.S. economy has been out of recession for months, but you wouldn't know it from today's jobs report. Instead of showing progress, the labor market sagged again, as firms ranging from construction to retail laid off tens of thousands in December. Heidi Shierholz works for the Economic Policy Institute, a labor think tank in Washington. She says today's report shows any jobs recovery will take time.
It's going to be a long haul. We're not only not adding jobs, we're still losing jobs at a steady pace right now.
The government says the economy began growing again in the summer and early fall, but most employers are still reluctant to hire. Mark Fittner is managing director at Wells Fargo. He says companies are uncertain about the strength of consumer demand, and they don't know how major legislation, such as health care reform, will affect their bottom line.
Businesses are saying, how am I going to commit to hiring workers when I don't know how much it's going to cost me to employ them? And if they don't know what it's going to cost to hire a worker, they're not likely to move forward with that decision until they feel a lot more certain about
what is true is we're all disappointed. I'm sure the American people are disappointed.
That's Christina Romer. She's the White House's chief economist, and she was reacting to today's labor report. Romer says recoveries can be slow and halting. For instance, the government's revised figures for November show the economy actually grew by 4,000 jobs that month. But 4,000 jobs is too small to have much of an impact in a labor market that employs more than 138 million people.
This is how real recoveries happen. They come in fits and starts, and now looks like November was a start and December was a little bit of a fit.
Romer noted a bright spot in today's report. Temporary hiring grew in December. That's the fourth month in a row, and it's important.
As companies start to ramp up and hire again, many of them usually turn to temporary labor first to get, you know, someone in the door quickly and get the work done.
Joni Ruge works for Adecco, the temporary services giant.
We're seeing an increase in some of our manufacturing customers. The demand for products is increasing, and they're starting to add people back, even in, you know, the warehouses and production facilities. So that's a very good sign.
But those new jobs for temp workers last month were offset by continued layoffs in the construction business. Carl Case is an economics professor at Wellesley College. He says the glut of foreclosures has reduced demand for workers to build new homes.
We're not building anything. People say, why should I buy a new house if I can get an old house that's deeply discounted to get it sold?
Economists say the labor market won't begin to grow until sometime this spring. Last month, the unemployment rate held steady at 10%, but economists think it will rise. That's because any job increases are expected to be modest, not enough to soak up the millions of people who are unemployed or the new workers entering the job market. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. A year ago, well into the economic downturn, the automaker Hyundai started offering worried customers this deal.
Buy any new Hyundai, and if in the next year you lose your income, we'll let you return it.
The program was called Hyundai Assurance. At the time, I spoke with John Krafcik about the program. He's president and CEO of Hyundai Motor America.
So if you quit your job, we don't cover you for that one. But, you know, if you're laid off, if your job causes you to relocate to another country, we cover that as well.
Well, that was a year ago, and we thought we'd check in with John Krafcik again to see how many takers Hyundai had. Welcome back to the program.
No, Michelle, thanks. It's great to be back.
So in 2009, how many cars returned under that Hyundai Assurance program?
You may be surprised to hear that it was less than 100 customers.
Put that in context for us. Fewer than 100 people returned their cars. How many cars did you sell?
Last year, we sold 435,064. So the fact that only 100 consumers had to take us up on the offer, we thought was actually pretty good news.
How many people did you think would return their vehicles?
Frankly, it was quite a bit lower than what we had expected, Michelle. And of course, in a way, this is, and we treated it almost like a kind of insurance, a kind of social insurance. So we had to make some, you know, financial set aside for it. And in the end, it ended up being substantially below what our expectations were. Thank goodness.
How much did the program cost Hyundai?
We're not sharing the specific costs of the program, but the good news is we have decided to continue to offer the program through 2010.
Did you attribute the strong year you had this year? You had a pretty good year, particularly in comparison to the other automakers. Do you think that that was in part because of this Hyundai Assurance program?
You know, Michelle, I do think it played a role. And the interesting thing about this industry, looking backwards, is you'll never know how much. It's hard to really tease out the specific impact of assurance. But we do think it was one of the most important things we had going for us in 2009 in terms of changing the way Americans think about Hyundai. It used to be all about, oh, they make a pretty good and expensive car. And now I think we've been able to add some texture. This was something we were doing on our own. You know, it was classic free enterprise working in an innovative way to build a great story and build demand for the brand. And we think it worked.
Do you think it worked in part because of the safety net, or was there some other almost kind of advertising psychology going on, that you were acknowledging something that people felt, essentially saying, we feel your pain? With the new ads that you have out now, you're saying, by now we hoped we'd be further down the road to recovery and we're not out of the woods yet. Is that the kind of thing that people were responding to as much as the offer to take the car back?
Exactly. Our program was designed to tackle that root cause of economic insecurity. And the way we set it was a very empathetic voice. I don't know if you know this, but we use Jeff Bridges in our commercials. And we think Jeff just did such a fantastic job in getting that empathetic tonality that Americans really seem to respond to.
Remind us, whose idea was this?
This came from our in-house marketing genius, a fellow named Joel Uwanik. He was out, as he often is, in focus groups way back in 2008 in October, essentially bringing potential car buyers together into a room about 15 at a time, asking the question, why aren't you guys buying cars? And just letting them talk. And that's where this insight came out of, yes, we understand the deals are good, but don't you understand we're worried about keeping our jobs? And Joel took those insights from that focus group, and then in a discussion with Mike Buckingham, the head of our Hyundai Motor Finance Captive group, he mentioned this program. And within 37 days, we had the commercials put together, the program approved, and we were on the air on January 2nd.
John Krafcik, thanks so much.
Thanks, Michelle.
John Krafcik is president and CEO of Hyundai Motor America.
While Americans start to whisper in hopeful tones about economic recovery, some states continue to register a disturbing sign of hard times. Bodies are being left unclaimed at local morgues. From Oregon Public Broadcasting, April Baer has the story.
To step into the morgue at the Oregon Medical Examiner's Office is to confront destitution at its most final. In this frigid, dark locker, the dead lie draped in plastic sheeting on steel tables. These aren't folks who died watched over by family. Dr. Karin Gunson's morgue is the first stop for people who were killed in car accidents or shootings, or who simply died at home by themselves.
Many times, if they happen to end up at the medical examiner's office, they have made some choices in their life where they're no longer very close to their family. That might be drugs or alcohol or just a wanderlust. It's extremely rare where we don't find someone.
Gunson says these people died unexpectedly, and their families, if they had families, weren't prepared. Oregon's one of several states that provides funding for so-called indigent burials. Historically, this money does a final service for people with no home or relatives. But in 2009, Gunson says an unprecedented number of bodies went unclaimed, some for a month or more, not because family couldn't be found, but because the economy has left families unable to pay for even the most basic $500 cremation.
We don't really want to become a storage place.
The trend is elusive to track. In Oregon, demand on the Indigent Burial Fund was so high last year, the legislature had to nearly triple fees on death certificates to keep the fund solvent. Illinois received so many requests for burial help that its funds were temporarily shut down over the summer. And in Michigan, where the economy hemorrhaged 300,000 jobs last year, indigent burials nearly doubled from 603 in 2008 to over 1,100. Oregon has avoided overcrowding in its morgues with an arrangement that sends unclaimed remains to funeral homes, who then solicit families for at least partial payment. That's when the real negotiating over final arrangements begins.
My mom called me and she's like, you might want to call them because nothing's been done and this is what's going to happen if nobody pays.
Last October, Rosemary Goldsworthy was still reeling from the shock of her father's death when the mortuary began phoning, asking for payment or else.
You know, he'll just get buried in a grave with a bunch of strangers who also aren't claimed and some county cemetery.
Goldsworthy and her fiancé live in a town with 14% unemployment. They're barely getting by on his part-time pay at a furniture factory. While she negotiated a rare payment plan for her father's burial, family members told her they wouldn't be able to help with the $340 down payment. This kind of bruising discussion, funeral directors say, is not uncommon these days. After months of negotiation, the mortuary finally agreed to release her father's ashes for a nominal fee. Goldsworthy says she thought constantly about what might become of his cremated remains and where they'd end up.
I want some of him. I want to have a part of my dad.
But what about families who can't pay, won't pay, or can't be found? Aaron Phelps is the owner of Omega Funeral and Cremation Services in Portland.
Down here we are. The cremated remains that are unclaimed, we keep them in this storage utility area.
In an unfinished corner of his mortuary's attic, Rows and rows of plain white boxes stand, neatly stacked, each one bearing the name of someone left unclaimed. Some 60 people have come to rest here over 16 years. Phelps says there's no doubt many surviving families are having real trouble meeting burial expenses. But he's also noticed more people finding reasons not to pay to bury the family's black sheep, expecting the Indigent Burial Fund to step in.
The thing I find the hardest to take is when there are people who have the resources and simply will not do anything.
So once every few months, when Phelps has a paid service scheduled at the Oregon coast, his staff will take along the remains for cases that he considers closed after years of research. The ashes of the unclaimed will be trucked out to the ocean and scattered in the waters of Tillamook Bay. For NPR News, I'm April Baer in Portland, Oregon.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.